Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Acclaimed novelist Alice Munro praises Edna O'Brien's talent, saying the Irish author writes the most beautiful, aching stories of any writer anywhere. In Edna O'Brien's 29th book, a collection of short stories, she tells modern-day tales set in London and New York, as well as in the Emerald Isle. But you can feel the ghosts of her native Ireland on each page. The book is titled Saints and Sinners. And, of course, Edna O'Brien joins me in the studio. It's been such a long time since you and I have seen each other. I'm so pleased to have you here.
So am I.
And please join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I know there are many, many of you who have read the many books of Edna O'Brien and enjoyed each one, so feel free to join us. Tell me your feelings about Ireland in this decade.
Well, it's that could take a book. I have many feelings about it. One thing is I am so glad that I am Irish. It continues to nourish me one way or another. It's full of stories. And my feelings about it alter as Ireland itself alters. The Celtic Tiger was a great time for some, and much bravado about wealth and showing off. But I think it wasn't as great as people thought it was. I think I revere poetry and literature. That has been what my life is attempting to be a student of, and sometimes practitioner. And that aspect of Ireland was sidelined in the great new wave of helicopters and all else. And I found that a little, more than a little, I found it disquieting. In fact, I'm writing a memoir, which at the moment is in stasis because I'm here with you. But I do have a chapter called Where Have All the Poets Gone? And I don't just mean published poets who published, but that sense, that engagement with language and with feeling, which Ireland, I think, is noted for. So my feelings about it, the crash that has come, is very sad for a lot of people. You see empty houses on a hillside, not just houses, whole blocks of houses, the damp cement windows boarded up. And Ireland is in a very chastened mood at this moment. They're very buoyed up by two visits, as you probably know well. The Queen was last week, and the President, who is a great friend of mine, Mary McAleese, invited me for a lunch with the Queen. And it was very cordial and informal, formal, of course, but it seemed informal. And many people have said, not just me, they never saw the Queen smile so much. The Irish soil suited her. And then, of course, today President Obama is there. And it's wonderful, you know, it's brief, these are brief visits. But it's wonderful for the sense, because there is some shame in Ireland of how they allowed themselves to financially crash.
You have actually written a poem about President Obama, and I would love to hear it.
Well, I'll have a go. I wrote it, I meant to bring it with me, but of course left it there. But it's for Obama, who is today in Moneygall, not far from where I come from, but I'm delivering it in Washington, so I think that's cosmopolitan. 2004, you glided on. Prince Hamlet himself from Illinois, a swank with a lava of language. Met your ghosts and raised them in belted sackcloth, chill smiles, a screed of ancient wrongs. Met the living, too, who feared your witchcraft and ordered daggers and several sets of masks. How far you were meant to travel, cutting through swathes of sky, losing or gaining an hour, puzzling the sad, the savage things. Taupe earth down below, signatures of heaped snows, the sad, the savage things. Yet each time you emerge debonair, as though from a game of tennis. The ones who waited on the roadside waited and were plenished. They were the ones who carried you hence, as you had carried them, in a beautiful, baffling synthesis. Now you are home. Brief is the banquet. Do you dream at night of boyish deeds long ago, and do you now begin to fold those dreams under bales of blissful snows? Your tailor has arrived to measure you for a greatcoat. After the fanfare and the anointing, there is the quiet room that some call a cell. There, poets weave epiphanies to the ranunculus that resembles the rose. There, monks kneel on stone and pray for nothingness. There, the Sphinx, staring straight at you, not saying a word, not even a nod, and weighs a ton.
Edna O'Brien reciting the poem she has written for President Obama in honor of his visit to Ireland. She has a brand new book of short stories out. It's titled Saints and Sinners. Do join us, 800-433-8850. You, my dear and old friend, left Ireland a long time ago.
Yes.
Yet you write with such passion about Ireland. It is as though Ireland is your long-lost love to whom you refuse to go back.
Well, I do go back. I think it's my matrix, as love is a big word. I do love some about it. It's the place where I was born, where I was made a writer. That landscape, those people, that language, that history, that mythology, that everything was in me, as indeed it would be in many, in everyone. So I do go back, but I have a very nice grave there, so just like to mention, on an island. I don't go back to live there. And the reason is complicated and maybe not fully apparent, even to me myself. When I first wrote The Country Girls was my first book, and much brouhaha happened over it, and people were very angry about it. And it was banned, and a little few copies were burnt in my native village, and all that, which is already well known. My reason for not going back is not to do with ill temper or holding grudges about being banned or treated pretty harsh down the years. One reviewer, for instance, called me the abasement Molly Bloom, and so on. My keeping away and yet, well, not that, coming and going seems to suit me as a writer, because to write, you have to be very private. You go out into the world and you absorb it and you immerse yourself in it. But the actual, like the cell that I mentioned in the Obama poem, to go back to the cell, you have to be by yourself. And I find that easier in a large city like London than in Ireland, where I know a lot of people and they know me. And therefore, over my shoulder, I would feel a sense of curiosity and perhaps judgment, which I don't wish. But at the same time, if like a Russian poet, Solzhenitsyn, or Joseph Brodsky, whom I knew Brodsky, I couldn't go back, that would be a very unbearable cut for me.
But it is the richness of that soil, the richness of that air and that place that infuses your work.
It's the richness, the wildness, the pain, the ghosts. It's everything, because richness is a big pot. It's like a soup. There's more than happiness or joy in richness. There's all those echoes. And, of course, the great heritage of writing that has been there. I wrote a short brief biography of James Joyce some years ago, and living with the works of James Joyce for 2 years was an enormous richness. But along with the richness of literature, there is the salient richness in the place itself, in the people, in the sense of narrative. Irish people, they're full of stories. And stories are hard to find now in this cosmopolitan world of ours.
Edna O'Brien, and her newest book of stories is titled Saints and Sinners. When we come back, I'll ask her to read from a few and take your calls. Stay with us. And welcome back. Edna O'Brien is with me. She is, in many, many ways, the voice that so many yearn to hear. Her truly of-the-heart stories and novels have inspired many people, including this person, Rodney, who has just sent us an email. He said that poem was simply poignantly powerful, fascinatingly insightful, and I hope she plans to give it to President Obama. Do you?
We need a messenger.
We can find you a messenger, I assure you. We can indeed. I want to ask you a little bit about The Country Girls.
Yes.
Because that book had such an impact, both negative and positive, depending on who was reading it. A lot of it includes facets of your own life.
Yes.
In convent, your own experiences. Tell us about that life in convent, how it led to this book, and what happened.
Oh, well, convent was very strict, as you know, And looking back on it, there were about 200 women all under the same roof. There were 70 boarders, as we were called. There were 70 nuns, and then there were some orphans in an adjoining building. So it was a ferment, if you like, of female longings, female crushes. You know, I was sure I would be a nun in that because I was in love with a nun. So it was also, I wouldn't think my education was that great or widespreading, but it was a different kind of education. I learned in the national school everything through Irish, and then in the convent I learned a bit of English as well. And we used to do drill out in an open courtyard. And just to hear a boy whistle, one always thought it was a boy rather than an old man. This was the tune and the sound of the outside world. So it was fervid and it was enclosed. And it was good education in one sense. It was so strict. So I think I'm a quite disciplined woman, even though I would love to be more harum scarum. But the book itself, I had always wanted to write from the youngest age, and I would write little snippets and hide them because I felt, with cause, that writing was something you might be judged by or you might even get into hot water over. So when I used to read for publishers, I used to read their manuscripts, which I got paid a guinea. And my essays or judgment of these other people's works, I think they were a little bit severe at times. And I was commissioned by the publishers to write a novel. And that novel became The Country Girls. I got £50, which would be $100 roughly. And an American publisher, Knopf, Alfred Knopf, Blanche Knopf, whom I met, and Hutchinson, a wonderful man. Everyone needs a good shepherd in their life. In fact, I would like ongoing good shepherds, if I could just mention. But this man was my good shepherd, and he asked me to write a book. And I was married. I was young, but married. I had, in true Victorian fashion, eloped. And with the man I was married to, and I had two children. I had them very young. I came to England. We came to England. And I found it so lonely, so alien, so everything, even the pigeons at Waterloo Station where we arrived with our luggage, they didn't seem like nature. They seemed like manufactured, you know, they waddled, they didn't fly, they didn't have the flight of birds. And I also felt, realized how deeply the cut, the severance from my own country was. I didn't realize it till I came to England. And I sat down every morning after bringing my children to the school with copybooks. I still write by hand. I'm probably one of the last to write by hand. And I wrote The Country Girls in a matter of weeks, under 3 weeks. It just poured out of me. This story, very simple, begins, I wakened quickly, sat up in bed abruptly. It is only when I am anxious that I waken easily. And for a moment I could not remember, but then I did. The old reason, my father, he had not come home. So it has an elegiac quality, as well as Baba being wild and rebellious and so on. And all went very well while I was writing it. I cried a lot while I was writing it. But the trouble was about to start with the publication. I had no idea that I would offend, and certainly never wanted to offend, so many people. My poor mother, who anyhow hated literature and realized it was a subversive act, she was so ashamed of me, as were all the villagers. And the priest in the at the sermon at Mass heard or knew that two women had bought copies. This will show you how wealthy writers are, two copies. And he asked that those copies be brought in. And there was a little burning in the parish grounds. I mean, I have talked of it before. Now I find it comic. It is ludicrous. But at that time, I felt, even though I knew I hadn't done wrong, I felt I had done wrong. Because they thought that I had brought shame on them. And I actually contend and think, you cannot write about a person or a place or a situation through hatred. That can be an editorial. But to actually write a book and conceive and make living people, even though a lot of it is stimulated by your own life, your own autobiography, you still have to, it's not a diary, it's not a letter. You have to make that world of characters and landscape and hens and songs and loneliness and longing to get out of there. Even though it gave me so much, I was also, the two girls, Baba and Kate, have only one longing, to break out of the convent, break out of their gem box, go to Dublin and meet men. You know, it's rather limited, but that's how people are. And when it was banned then, that was very, that brought more thunderbolts.
Banned throughout Ireland.
Banned through, oh yes. There were a lot of books banned in Ireland. I wasn't alone, but I was singled out for a couple of reasons. One was I was a woman, and there hadn't been much tradition of women writing. Secondly, I was a young woman, 24 or 5. And thirdly, the nature of the book seemed defiant because it's written in very simple, accessible language. And Baba, you know, is not only sarcastic, she's irreverent. And her language is Kate is poetic and Baba curses. And I don't know where the idea, people have asked me always if Baba was someone I knew. And indeed, I was persecuted by many girls at school, as happens. But I think Baba was the secret side of myself that I could allow her to say things that I was thinking. And it started me off, but at the same time, I was very, very frightened. Frightened in that I got ugly letters and all that, that happens, but frightened that, and we'll show you how stubborn I am and probably unfrightened in the end, but frightened about doing the next book. Because one book, you know, one swallow never made a summer. One book is not enough. And since then, one tiny thing I'll tell you when you're about transforming people's lives. I sometimes go to book festivals, Edinburgh, wherever, and I'm signing a few books. And a woman came up to me at one of these signings, and she said, "I went to the same convent as you." "Oh," said I, getting a little nervy. And she said, "You know, we said the rosary for you every single night." And I said, "What good has it done me?"
And the other story related to that book is what your mother did with that book.
Yes, that's a more painful. I dedicated the book to my mother and I sent her a copy. It was never discussed whether she'd read it or not read it, but she was opposed to the book and opposed to the furore it caused for her and everyone. And she did begin to soften, and she was a great woman, my mother, but she was a formidable woman, and there was no ethos of writing or reading. There was no library in the town. So I was like a buccaneer, if I can use such a word. And after she died, we were clearing up, and, you know, all her clothes and all this. And in a bolster case, big white bolster case, tucked into it, not in the room, outside, was The Country Girl. So I took it out, it was a bit mildewed, and I opened it at random. And I saw a lot of black ink through lines. So then I turned the pages, and I saw more black ink. And my poor mother, she had gone through the book line by line, and with black ink, inked out any offending words. And at that moment, Diane, when I came on that, and I was crying and I was raging, had my mother been alive, I would have addressed her on it. But subsequently, not just because I'm older, but because I think or thought myself into her situation, of how much it must have meant to her, how awful it was for her. And of course I forgive her, but of course I wish she had read it.
What is so remarkable is that, as you've just said, there were no libraries in the town. There were, I think there was one book Rebecca.
Rebecca, yes.
That got passed around, not necessarily.
In sequence.
In sequence. No. How in the world did you read that?
Well, I didn't get many pages. I would have loved to. I mean, in the first lines, last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again. Everyone knows. Other people would tell you, did Max de Winter? Is he going to kill his second wife? Is Mrs. Danvers going to, and so on. But as regards becoming a writer, and I think this would be true for people in this country as well, oddly enough, out of a lonesome place and not much advantage or culture as such, as it's called, the need and the determination to write is even stronger. Virginia Woolf has said that in another form, and she came from a very intellectual family. But she was always glad that she had not had a university education. So am I. Because the feeling, the tenderness, the youthfulness and the appetite is something stimulated from not having. I mean, I often think, I look at a picture of James Dean, for instance. I have a wonderful photograph, postcard of James Dean. And he was wearing a cap. And out of that lonely place that he was from, you can see the loneliness around it, the emptiness, you can see his determination. But the irony is, we can't forsake the place we came from. We can leave it, but not forsake it.
Edna O'Brien, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Would you read for us a segment of your choosing?
Sure. Well, now, the choosing. This is from a story called Inner Cowboy. It's about an innocent boy who gets caught up in the web of the moguls and the rich. And this is a moment of him speaking. His granny loved the olden days when shops were drapery and grocery and hardware all in one. At the town square on a fair day every Christmas, she sold her turkeys and was still calling to get her turkeys back. After she lost her husband and was all alone, she got a pattern book and crocheted a beautiful white bed shawl. That kept her alive. But she wasn't as clued up as she used to be and dozed a lot in the chair and came awake, always saying the same thing. Oh, Curly, you asked for a biscuit and a Coca-Cola and I gone and got you a biscuit and a glass of milk. Curly preferred the bog to the quarries. The quarries were big, ugly places, cross places, noisy places. Flying dust everywhere, showers of it black and gritty from all that crushing and all that blasting. The bogs were more peaceful. Stretching to the horizon, a dun brown with cushions of moss and sphagnum and the cut turf in little stooks, igloos, with the wind whistling through them, drying them out. The birds flew high up in the air, only came down at night to feed and to suck. At school, the master read from an encyclopedia that bogs were a place to bury butter, to take a shortcut, and to dispose of a murdered one. Curly helped in the bog in the summer, because even though turf was cut with machinery, it still needed the human hands, to lay it and foot it and bag it and bring it home.
Edna O'Brien, reading from one of the short stories in her new collection. It's titled Inner Cowboy, and the book is titled Saints and Sinners. Such beautiful language, Edna, that some of us may not be totally familiar with.
Oh, yes. Should I do a little translation? Which words?
Words that perhaps we have seen before, perhaps we've heard before, but haven't really recognized them as purely Irish words.
Yes, I suppose they are. I think I write unconsciously. I'm not thinking what I will write. And then you come or you say to me, and it strikes me as, oh, that word. One of the things about words is we have all the words. I'm not the first who said this. James Joyce said it. He said, I have all the words. It's a question of putting them in the right order. And I wouldn't want, just for nostalgia's sake, to kind of bring a word that was a bit fey or a bit Celtic for its own sake. When writing, I want the words I chose to be what that character would choose. In different stories here, Madame Cassandra, the rather effete Anglo-Irish wife, wouldn't use those words. So I'm always groping to find the absolute word that will hit the nail on the head, and I often fail.
Edna O'Brien, who doesn't fail very often, her new book of short stories titled Saints and Sinners. Short break and right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kauffman Foundation, working to grow economies and expand human welfare. Learn more at kauffman.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Jimmy Fallon talks about learning how to interview for his late night show.
I didn't know what to do. I mean, interview strangers. I interviewed my mom. I don't know how
was
to
she
do
a good
this.
Guest? Would she be good?
She was an awful guest. She was an awful guest. She kept wanting to cut to a clip, and we have no clip.
Join us.
And welcome back. Writer Edna O'Brien has been praised throughout the world. She has at least 29 books to her credit, the latest a collection of short stories. It's titled Saints and Sinners. We have a number of callers. Let's go first to Ron in Manchester, New Hampshire. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm a fourth-generation Irish-American. My mother's maiden name was O'Brien. Don't know if I'm related to your guest or not, but I was listening to her reading the poem she wrote for President Obama, and I was reflecting on the fact that President Obama is not our first Irish president, and the long tradition of the Irish-American experience, thinking probably the biggest population of Irish people outside of Ireland is probably in the United States. I just would like to maybe get a comment from your guest's point of view about that connection between the United States and Ireland for, you know, those of us who are Irish but haven't ever actually visited Ireland.
Well, I think the questioner would be living here would be able to comment on it better. There is a huge Irish diaspora, and when I was growing up, America was not only the land of plenty, but was a kind of paradise. My mother had been to America. She had worked as a maid in Boston, in Brooklyn for years. As regards the integration of Irish people into America, I think it's almost seems effortless the way it has happened. And Irish Americans come home in the summer to County Clare, and where I am from. And it's interesting to watch. They're both glad to be back and in some sense look for their roots. And yet they couldn't come back. They couldn't come back forever.
You mentioned that you and your husband eloped.
Yes. Well, I did the eloping. The man I married, if you like, had the carriage.
Tell me what happened before you got away.
Well, it's not a cheerful story, but it's part of my life's experience. I was younger than my years, which is to say I wasn't very experienced in life. And I met this most amazingly good-looking and indeed intellectual and man who was 20 years older than me. And it was the first time I was carried away. There is no doubt about that. I was carried away by his fluency and by what seemed a man of real sensibility, who was also a writer. And I think this is really the nub of it. I had made no secret of the fact that I wanted to write, but I was writing little silly things, you know, descriptions of clouds or something, and that I would spout, or I would ream off bits of James Joyce's Dubliners. So my enthusiasm far exceeded my abilities, and yet it was in me a determination. And the first few years we lived in the country, where it's funny, I come from the country, I write about nature, but between you and I on the wall, as they say at home, I prefer living in cities. I don't know why. I can ruminate on the country better when I'm not in it. And then I wrote this book, The Country Girls, by request from the person I mentioned to you. And my husband was, I think he was surprised, but he was also undermined by it. I had not written it to undermine him, not at all. He's not in it, but it's about Ireland girls and all the things, the big past that I brought with me. And that was, I wasn't that happy ever, because I had married in haste, or I had eloped in haste. My parents wanted to take me from a shop where I worked, a chemist shop in Dublin, and I literally ran down streets to him, to a bus, where I didn't have the bus fare even, the country. So to say I belonged in a Victorian novel, or even earlier than Victorian novel, Lord Ullin's Daughter, you know, come back, he cried in grief and so on, is absolutely true. And I found life, I had worked in this chemist shop, and I found life alone in the country, very lonely, very solitary. But a very good thing came from it. My husband had paid for me to join a good library where you could get books immediately. I remember getting Scott Fitzgerald and Hemingway and feeling I was in another universe. But the publication of The Country Girls in the domestic, in a different, in the public it was a disgrace, and in private it was something of a disgrace, or at least something that created conflict.
For your husband.
For my husband. And I then wrote the second book, The Lonely Girl, which is called Girl with Green Eyes. And there was going to be a film, the fact there was a film made of that. So everything got unhappier. And one day, rather like Nora in Ibsen's The Doll's House, I just left. I left with no possessions, just the coat I was wearing.
But you had two children.
I had two children, and that became a big, long, tortuous battle.
For the children.
Yes, and for me, and probably for their father, but he was a more authoritative person. And I felt, even though I'd written these two books, I didn't feel I had any power or independence or a way to... I did eventually get it sorted, but it took a long time because I suppose I was afraid of him, and that makes you powerless or helpless. Looking back on it, you see, we all, the awful cliche, we learn from our mistakes. Looking back on it, I could have been a lot more forceful, but I wasn't. And
I think we all learn from our fears as well.
We do, but the interesting thing about fears is you conquer that fear, and then another one comes up.
Of course.
So it's an ongoing school of learning.
Totally. Would you read for us from Green Georgette?
From Green Georgette, that's number three. Ah, yes. This is a visit of a mother and a daughter to the local bank clerk and his wife, Big Shots, as they would have been called. Didn't go very well because Mrs. Cockland, the wife, was really irked by this provincial mother. And it's from the point of view of the little girl the story is told. "So glad you could both come," Mrs. Cockland said, "but it lacked warmth. It was like telling us that we were dull and lustreless and that we were not people of note. Well, now I can say I met the grand Mrs. Cockland," Mama said tartly, as we walked home, and she repeated her old adage about old friends and new friends. When you make new friends, forget not the old, for the new ones are silver, but the old ones are gold. We were in a gloom. The grass was heavy with dew, cattle lying down, munching and wheezing. She did not warn me this time to lift my feet in order to preserve my white shoes, as she was much preoccupied. There was no light from our kitchen window, which signified that my father had gone up to bed, and we would have to bring him a cup of tea and humour him, as otherwise he would be testy on the morrow. I had this insatiable longing for tinned peaches, but Mama said it would be an extravagance to open a tin at that hour, while promising that we would have them some Sunday with an orange souffle, which she had just mastered the recipe for. Mixed in with my longing was a mounting rage. Our lives seemed so drab, so uneventful. I prayed for drastic things to occur, for the bullocks to rise up and mutiny, then gore one another, for my father to die in his sleep, for our school to catch fire, and for Mr. Cockland to take a pistol and shoot his wife, just prior to shooting himself. So we all have what they call our bad thoughts.
Indeed.
Our wicked thoughts.
Edna,
our murderous Brian, thoughts.
Her new book is titled Saints and Sinners. Let's take a call from Dallas, Texas. Nefertiti, you're on the air.
Oh, God bless you. I'm Nefertiti, and I'm originally from Liberia. And my father was a diplomat to England and Ireland. I was struck by the beauty of Ireland, the landscape. And I'm also a writer, went to convents like you, went to England as the only little black girl in the all-white boarding school, and had all those dumb questions asked about Africa. So I've never seen a lion or tiger since I went to the London Zoo. But I'm 65 now. I have several novels I'm trying to write, and I'm so inspired by what I heard today. And my question is also, would you suggest that after copywriting your material to find an agent, or what do you think about self-publishing today? You know, there's always the fear of not wanting to have everything authentic about what you're doing, you know, just watered down to size. What would you suggest to writers like me?
Well, what I would suggest to you, if you want to write, write. Do it with all your heart, all your instinct, all your head, everything about you. You are the doer. You have no control over what will happen to it, in the sense that publishing today, as you brought up, is harder. But if you're serious about it, It's the doing of it that will count, and it's your own truth. Your own truth. And funnily enough, I had something I copied from John Donne that I will read to you, that I was going to read to Diane at the end of the program. And it says, and it's about writing, whether we be young or old, our destiny, our being's heart and home, is with infinitude and only there. I know it sounds very lofty and highfalutin, but if you think on that, writing to me and to anyone who is serious about writing, as I trust you are, is like religion. It is holy. It is not a secular. It's secular in that you earn your living and want to get it published. But in the doing, you have to be as humble and at the same time as proud and adventurous. And that's my only advice to you. You still have to go into that room by yourself and get it done.
Always by yourself and confronting that page, confronting yourself.
Yes.
As you begin to write. Nefertiti, I wish you all success. Good luck to you. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Edna O'Brien, considering that your book, The Country Girls, which was written in 1960, was banned by the Irish censor, burned by priests for its depiction of convent life, what is your reaction with how the Roman Catholic Church has been responding to the sex abuse scandals and this latest study?
I think they have been disgraceful. For years in Ireland, in this country, in every country, this abuse, every form of abuse from priests and nuns and Christian brothers has been going on. And it was covered up with, in the case of Ireland, the collusion of church and state, because in Ireland, church, state was church and church was state. What people suffered and what they suffered silently, and they could not tell anyone, these young people in institutions, they could not tell because to tell were finished. So they lived with that. And what I am surprised is to question the very ethos of what Christianity is. It was not Christian. Jesus Christ would not have done it. So these followers, very secular in their way, priests, parish priests, bishops, wielded the wand of power and not the wand of truth or holiness to a great deal. I'm not saying all priests or all bishops were like that. And some, I would imagine, are very ashamed and contrite. But if you take the great, the Vatican, and from the Vatican down to a parish in County Clare, it's power. It's about power. And in that sense, it is political rather than spiritual.
Is it the same today?
No, it's better. But there were two very long reports published in Ireland, and they were brilliant. They were heartbreaking. I shouldn't use the word brilliant, but they were so thorough, is what I mean, where they got witnesses, got people, and their stories were told. And what happened, not once, not twice, but happened all the time. And Ireland was shocked. Now, people knew about it, but it's very easy for human nature, all of us, to put to one side or repress the thing we would rather not have aired or told. So it did create a lot of, it was open, it was discussed. The Archbishop's house, people stood outside the Archbishop of Dublin, his house, on hunger strike. And they had placards voicing what they felt. Outside the Pro-Cathedral in Dublin, there were little infant's shoes with black ribbon, which for all of those who had been deprived of, as it was said, of their childhood. And it wasn't just their childhood, it was their psyches, it was their youth. So I think it is a very good thing that it has been brought to light. But I do not think the official of the hierarchy have been as quick to act on it or condemn it as they might be. Because again, there is this whole thing of we are the powerful people, we are the authority, and you are the littler person and your voice. But voices are being heard, And who knows, from it, I'm sure the Catholic Church has lost a great number of its congregation, I'm sure, because you go into chapels, they're emptier. But from it, a lesson might be learned. That is, one has to hope these things. And that lesson would be to go back to what is great and to many people essential about religion.
Edna O'Brien, her new book of short stories, a wonderful collection, is titled Saints and Sinners. How good to see you again.
Well, I'm sure you can always interrupt me in my answers if you want to, you know, you can.
But I wouldn't dream of it. Thank you for being here. And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.